Jason.
Thanks very much. Yeah, so thanks to everyone for sticking it out until the bitter end here. I'm going to assume this is interest in the Galactic Center and accretion in the Galactic Center, and not just that everybody's flight to the East Coast got canceled. That's how I'm going to interpret it anyways. Yeah, so I'll talk about this exciting opportunity that we have in especially ongoing and in the next few years to spatially resolve regions very close to black holes with this Event Horizon Telescope and gravity experiment. And particularly, I'll focus on the case of Sag J star after Monica discussed M87. And this work, my part of this work at least, started not that long after I was a grad fellow here at KITP, 8 years ago now, during my PhD with Eric Agal in Seattle, and has carried on in recent years, mostly in collaboration with undergraduate students at Berkeley, and then also Alejandra Jimenez-Rosales, who's now a PhD student in my group in Garching. Okay, so you've heard about Sag J star, but this is basically the test bed for low luminosity accretion theory as we know it now. This ordinary black holes, most of the black holes, most of the time, well below Eddington, with an SED here that looks nothing like a quasar or any of the other objects we've seen so far, where basically it's completely optically thin. The very low densities mean that the radiation comes out as synchrotron radiation. The electrons stay very hot, which also, so the electrons are relativistic. And what we see here is this radio spectrum and the synchrotron radiation, which looks pretty similar to most low luminosity AGN. I mean, in this source, at least, peaks in this submillimeter bump that I'll really focus mostly on today. And there's also these interesting near-infrared and X-ray simultaneous flaring emission that will be very exciting for one of the interferometric experiments, but I won't discuss that as much today. Okay, and just, the statement that most of these AF acronyms that Jim referred to briefly earlier, most of these came about because of observational tests provided by the Galactic Center over many years now. Okay, another reason that this is so exciting now is that this black hole, Sag J star, has the largest opening angle of its event horizon on the sky. So it's shown as a function of distance for some nearby supermassive black holes. And M87 is here and maybe should be a factor of 2 higher, so it's the other candidate for this. And so we know, and the other exciting thing in the Galactic Center is from the excellent observations of stellar orbits, we have a very well-determined black hole mass, and from many observations know the distance to the Galactic Center, this opening angle goes as m over d, and so the expected size of the event horizon on the sky, or really what we hope to observe, this black hole shadow on the sky, is well known. And so then in the spatially resolved data, you can hope to look for this signature at a known size on the sky so that it hopefully won't be confused with other features of the images, like the images that Monica showed. Again, this feature was originally predicted by Jim Bardeen, just calculating what is the effective cross-section of a black hole to light coming from behind it, and it's several times larger than the event horizon size. And you can take this spatial scale and just ask then in the submillimeter or in the near-infrared, what telescope size, effective resolution size do you need to observe this, or to spatially resolve this emission? And it's about 10 to the 4 kilometers at 1 millimeter. So this is basically, the size of the Earth, or Earth-type sizes. And in the near-infrared, it's 10 kilometers, which not quite doable yet, but we can try to get there with astrometry, so centroiding an unresolved point source as a function of time to watch motions then of the emission near the black hole. OK, so I'll talk just one slide just to say that this experiment where I work, this VLTI gravity instrument, is now operational and has observed the Galactic Center. And the goal of this is taking basically these telescopes, 10-meter class telescopes, that are used to trace out the stellar orbits in the Galactic Center and putting them together as an interferometer with the VLTI. And now this instrument pushes the limit of optical interferometry to very, very faint objects. You can actually do this experiment on the Galactic Center. And now you can do a factor of 10 or maybe even 100 better in astrometry of those orbits, so looking for GR effects in known stellar orbits, looking for known stars that are even closer to the black hole where the relativistic effects should become large, and then also looking for this sort of wander of the centroid of a flare as a function of time. Again, there are observations already, as I said, but really this is happening this year for the first time, led by many people, a large consortium in Europe. Okay, another experiment that has been referred to already, but that I'll spend most of the time talking about is this Event Horizon Telescope experiment. So as of 2007, when the first observations of Sag J star were done with the array looked something like this. This is the view of the Earth from Sagittarius A star. And there were three submillimeter stations here. And for people familiar with interferometry, you know that you're not going to make a very nice image, like, you know, these ALMA images with rings and things with this array. But nonetheless, you can learn something about source structure, as we'll discuss. But just to say that the reason that people are excited, and I think it's, you know, not really correct to say that these observations are happening for the first time this year. It's actually been an ongoing project in radio astronomy for 40 or more years, and at this frequency, where you can actually resolve the shadow of the black hole potentially for the last 10 years. But the reason people are so excited about the observations that will happen in the next couple months is because the array will look more like this. And the crucial thing is that ALMA will be used phased up as one station in the VLBI array, which drastically improves the sensitivity so that you can then detect Sag A star easily on what should be with all other sites. And also be the observations with the South Pole telescope. Because you have southern dishes now, you can also use European telescopes, like the 30-meter dish. So anyways, this is the reason that this is so exciting for the observations this year. Okay, but I'll talk about this connections of the theory of MHD accretion with mostly the observations that came from, you know, times when it looked like this, to give us an idea of maybe what to expect, or at least what are the first models we can rule out with the data that we get when it looks more like this. Okay, so this is shown the data from this first observation in 2007. So this is the visibility amplitude, the Fourier transform of the image intensity, plotted here in 1D as a function of baseline length, because there were only three baselines. This is, you're safe doing this. And what's shown here is just the source is nicely resolved. So you can then, what you have to do is take models. So for instance, you can take a Gaussian model of your source structure and fit it to these points, and these points out here are really what are telling you, measuring your size. And you show that this model has the size you need to fit the data is about 40 microarc seconds, which is about 4 Schwarzschild radii for the known 4 million solar mass black hole at 8 kiloparsecs. And this is really what we mean, that you're detecting now event horizon scale emission in the galactic center from this detection basically out at long baseline here. Okay, the exciting thing is that, well, I don't know, maybe I don't really expect that the image should look like a Gaussian. Maybe I expect it should look something like what was shown before, that had this black hole shadow in the middle of it. And in that case, then, your Fourier transform will show this minimum in the real parts, so the minimum in the amplitude here, at the spatial scale corresponding to that shadow. And then you get a model that looks more like this dotted line here. And so one goal, then, at a basic level, is to show that this is actually present in the data at the location we expect. And that then we can actually detect a black hole shadow in the data. Okay, but again, you know, the goal of the conference is to test MHD accretion theory, not to really test annuli of constant brightness or Gaussians with certain full-width half-maxes. So I'll describe the efforts that we've done using these ideal GR-MHD simulations, very similar to what Monica described, and then doing radiative transfer calculations from them, calculating these images, comparing to the data, and seeing what we can learn from that comparison. Yeah, that's right. So I think it's really that there's the main errors are from the calibration solution. So it is systematics. And so what they do is then typically add 10% or something to all the errors. This gets better as the number of stations goes up because your calibration gets better. But I this is actually an issue of concern to me that if you're going to get exquisitely sensitive ALMA data, you don't then want to be adding 10% systematic errors onto that, right? So it is an issue of some concern, I would say. Okay, and just so from this detection alone, actually from the compact size of the emission, we already just immediately learned something about the emission region, presumably very close to the black hole. So we know the flux density and we know the size, so we can calculate then the brightness temperature. And we find that this is several times 10 to the 10 Kelvin, so relativistic electrons. And you can compare that it's somewhat colder than the virial temperature. Okay, and from other observations, again, we know the flux density, we know the size, we know the black hole mass and other things. And you can now sort of construct very simple one-zone models of what the plasma parameters have to be in the emission region around the black hole. So, you know, there's field strengths of something like 10 to 100 Gauss, extremely low particle densities, as has been referred to already, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 per cubic centimeter. Okay, but so you can sort of think of the models that I'll show from the simulations as we already know that they have to satisfy these basic properties, right? But we'd like to, of course, narrow this down more and then figure out what we can learn about MHD from measuring these properties. Okay, and really, you know, as of the time that around, I don't know when, starting in, I guess, 2005 when this was first being done, but this was a great first problem to try to compare GRMHD simulations, the ideal GRMHD, no, you know, Hall effect, no resistivity, no anything in particular, and certainly no radiation forces or even cooling. You can ignore cooling in the galactic center because it's so underluminous. So this is a great first problem for the calculations. And this particular issue of what does the emission look like on horizon scales is great because the simulations only go out to, in this early generation, something like 20 gravitational radii. So we know the emission has a source size of about, you know, several Schwarzschild radii. So this is really perfect. We can actually fit, shown here, the emission region in synchrotron radiation inside the simulation domain and actually capture the emission that we see. Okay, as we've heard, the major issue that we have is that it's not actually a collisional plasma. There's no thermalization or no equilibration of ion and electron temperatures. And so then we get into this regime where what we see is the emission from the electrons, and so we have to assume something about what the electrons in the fluid are doing. And in the results that I'll show, so this has been talked about by Sasha and Monica, but I'll use the old-fashioned assumption for most of the results that I'll show. Just taking the electron temperature to be a constant fraction of the proton temperature. So basically just saying you have an internal energy in the simulation everywhere, assign a constant fraction of that to electrons, and that's a free parameter. And the claim is that most of the results that I'll show do not, at least qualitatively, depend on that assumption. In these newer electron models, I think most of the images certainly look quite similar. Okay, and then the goal is, right, we need to add in go from these emission maps in kind of the coordinate domains, this is the radial direction, the vertical direction, spin axis is pointing here, and we want to calculate what this actually looks like. What do the images actually look like? So this is using this GR trans, radiative transfer code, in GR, and I'll just show what an example of some of these images. So we've heard already the main effects that we have here are Doppler beaming. So this view right now is edge on. So the gas that's coming towards us on this side is beaming its radiation towards us, and deboosted here, and then you can see behind the accretion flow, so you see this emission coming from above and below from the torus here. And I just want to comment, a lot of people have seen images like this, especially in the context of thin accretion disks, and just here the main difference is that synchrotron emission when it's optically thin or marginally optically thin is much more steeply dependent on radius, say, than the thin disks, and that's why these images tend to look very compact, and the emission comes from very close to the black hole, as compared to what you would expect from say, a thin accretion disk, where it's a little more extended. Okay, so we'll watch a movie now of what happens when the inclination changes and the simulation goes on. So starting at edge-on viewing, and then going to face-on, and then back. So when the viewing angle is close to edge-on, you get this strong Doppler beaming effects here. And now as we rotate back towards face-on, that becomes less prominent. You can see there's this shadow feature in the middle. You can maybe see there's this static feature here, which is the circular photon orbit, so the boundary between the shadow and the gas, where photons are actually traveling around the black hole one or more times and tends to be a bright ring in the calculations. You can see now there's MHD turbulence in these simulations, drives this kind of M equal 1 structure that's imprinted in the synchrotron emission. And then you can see as we go back towards edge-on, it becomes more the Doppler beaming becomes dominant again, leading to asymmetry in the images that we observe. Again, so I think in this calculation it was 0.92, but yeah, the images look qualitatively similar for, well, spins that I have tried. I have not seen a strong signature of spin. Again, the goal then, especially in these early models, was to just take the models. As you can see, the images change a lot, you know, say as a function of inclination angle or something like that, and you can just ask which ones, you know, do any of them match the data, which ones do best, what can we say from that comparison. Okay, so the first key summary, you know, executive summary of this work is that a wide range of underlying physical models, ranging from kind of simple disks to what I showed, that has images like this, to jets, like what Monica showed for M87, to disks where the angular momentum is misaligned from the, has an angular momentum axis misaligned from the spin axis of the black hole, where you get shock heating and spots. In all cases, these images that are picked out by the data, at least, tend to look like crescent shapes. And so one thing that we did, for instance, is with a student, Ivan Binkhamruddin, was to then just make a geometric crescent model that we can use then and show that it matches the data better than the Gaussians and the ring models that were being used before. And so the point then, the main takeaway from this, is that the relativistic effects will tend to dominate if the emission really comes from very close to the black hole, right? Doppler beaming and the light bending become so strong that models that are quite physically different, and if you look at, say, the simulation movies, end up to the observations looking very similar. And we're certainly not the only group that's looked into this. So starting from, I think this is the first crescent image that I'm aware of, at least from Bromley et al. And then also, you know, Monica has worked on a lot on this, and Avery Broderick from analytic models. And then also more recently, the Arizona group too. So many groups find qualitatively similar crescent images that are dominated by these relativistic effects. I just want to briefly, Monica explained this nicely, but I just wanted to briefly go back to this. So we had this crazy idea when we put in a rather naive and much more simplistic model for the emission of M87. We found that actually if you go to low inclination for a jet, it can also make one of these crescent type images from this emission from the counter jet. And so I just wanted to go through how this actually works. So if you look edge on at one of these models, then you have this Doppler beaming where you have helical jet motion going up here, going down here. But the orbit, and you see these spots where it's coming towards you. But then as you rotate this image towards face on, you can see that the forward jet contribution gets smaller and smaller and kind of disappears, while what becomes the counter jet becomes brighter and brighter because it's strongly lensed from being so close behind the black hole. So when you look at, you know, inclinations like we know of in M87, you actually expect if the emission is coming from close enough to the black hole, that you should see the counter jet strongly lensed and the forward jet's emission should be captured by the black hole or, you know, lensed to the other side. So this is, I think, at the time we were excited about this at the time that we made the predictions for M87, but also knew that the model we put in to do this was very simplistic. And so I'm actually very excited now with the work that Monica has done recently that, you know, maybe we'll actually see a counter jet image in M87. And wouldn't that be cool for seeing the shadow in particular of the black hole? Okay, so maybe one first guess then for what the images should look like is this crescent shape. And that, I would say, is great if you want to detect the shadow because you have contrasting emission above and below the black hole that you can use to pick out the fact that there's a shadow in the middle. So if you, you know, calculate the visibilities for what they should look like, you see signatures that reflect the presence of a shadow in the middle, or of course, if you do image reconstruction or stuff like that. That part's great. If you want to test MHD theory using these images, it's probably not the best thing that they all look the same. It's probably not what you might have hoped to see, right? That a jet actually can look like a disk if you put the emission too close. And so in the rest of the talk, I'll give a few examples of work that we've done trying to get at, you know, other ways or ways that we can get at actually the accretion physics or the plasma physics of the gas around the black hole. From the data, because we have much more basically than just static images like this. Okay, so the first example is what we can do in the simulations. We can take that movie, we can integrate each frame, and just calculate a light curve at 1.3 millimeters. And an early example of this is shown here, where the dotted line is just the accretion rate onto the black hole, and the solid line is the synchrotron emission at 1.3 millimeters, just showing that it's very well correlated. The variability that we see in the model is just from fluctuations in N and B from MHD turbulence. And it actually looks qualitatively very much like the variability that's seen in Sagittarius Star at these wavelengths. So as one just very simplistic example, just taking a cut of a light curve that kind of looked like this, and here's a light curve of Sagittarius Star that looks kind of like that, but with roughly the right variability amplitudes and timescales to what's seen. Again, we can, I think, you know, we can make that a little bit more quantitative now, but I think the key test, kind of similar to what Chris Reynolds described for the propagating fluctuations idea, has not been done in this context and really needs to be done. So what we can do is we can calculate a power spectrum. It looks weird because it's folded through a weird transfer function to compare to the data, because the light curves are not regularly sampled. But the idea is that actually here the line is the data and the models are the points. But you basically see red noise variability with a power law index similar to 2 in the models do that as well. So they're in agreement with the data in that sense, but that's kind of limited to these certain range of timescales. The other thing that we've done is there's a lot of archival data of observations of the galactic center and the submillimeter, and you can compile huge light curves and just ask, what is kind of the length at which the variability process relaxes? So it's this red noise on short timescales, but if you go to some point, the power spectrum will turn over, or equivalently here shown this structure function here. And you can measure this more robustly than reading it off from this plot, and just show that there's a relaxation time that's about 8 hours in the galactic center. And to me, that seems like a short timescale. So certainly if you compared this to what's seen in X-ray binaries, it's very short. And I think it remains to be understood what sets this, and with longer simulations. So the ones I showed kind of last 24 hours, not the perfect length to try to measure things at 8 hours. But I think with some of the newer simulations, it's something that we should start to look at, is can we actually explain this? I mean, is this some property of the MHD, or what goes into this? Okay, as a next example, as we've nicely heard already, the models that I've shown are not good enough in that they do not produce the spectrum that's observed. So this is a nice example from Monica's work, just showing that this idea of a jet inside JSTAR has been around for a long time. At the same time that there were ADAFs, there was also the jet model. And so there were basically two solutions for how you get the radio spectrum here. So the models that I've shown are basically this red dashed line. So you can explain the submillimeter, which is what we've focused on, but you can see now why I haven't shown you, SED comparisons, because they don't match this at all. They act almost like those one-zone models that I show, almost like if you just put in a single population of electrons and calculated the synchrotron emission. So you either then need to have a jet contribution, which can nicely explain the radio emission. Models very similar to Monica's done, very similar for Sagittarius, which he showed for M87 from simulations. Or you can put non-thermal electrons. You could say, well, we know that the electrons in the accretion flow in this limit should not thermalize. There's no reason that they should be completely thermal. Let them have some tail out to higher energies. And you can show then, this is examples from Avery Project, the idea goes back further that you can explain the radio spectrum in this way by having some contribution from a power law tail of electrons. And I just want to say something that I think is really neat is that actually this contribution, you can see in the model here, this contribution still shows up at the submillimeter. And actually this has a pretty big impact, at least in this model, on what you should see in the images. So to understand this, it's worth asking just what do these images that I've shown look like as you change the temperature? So you keep the emitted flux to match the observations, and then you just change the temperature of the electrons by hand. And this is work that's led by Alvin Mao, who's now a grad student at Princeton. And the basic idea is that when the electrons are cold, then you need a large emitting area to produce the observed flux. It's optically thick. And so you get, look at this synchrotron photosphere here. Then as you approach, the brightness temperature at the inner edge of the disk, you get a minimum, actually, in the size. Right? It gets smaller, as you expect. You see down into the source, and it becomes optically thin here. Something that at least I initially, maybe I should have expected this, but I did not initially, is that this is a minimum. When you turn up the electron temperature more, the image becomes bigger again. And this is basically the fact that you can now radiate out to the radius where the critical synchrotron frequency in the fluid is equal to the observed frequency. And that becomes larger as you turn up the temperature. Basically, the electrons farther away become better at radiating at your frequency. And so the image actually gets bigger again. And this means that if you take this model where you have one core temperature and then add high energy electrons, you get this effect where you suddenly have a halo of emission surrounding here. So you get this diffuse halo of emission. This is plotted on some square root type scale so that you can actually see it because it's very low surface brightness. But actually, this type of feature is, you can see it's kind of almost isotropic compared to the other emission. The beaming is less important. And this is exactly the type of thing that interferometry, even with only a few baselines, can pick up, right? Because it's just a size. You're just saying the image should appear bigger if there are non-thermal electrons out here. So actually, we can already constrain the kind of fraction of the flux that can come from high-energy electrons in the accretion flow just from the measured size, which is small. Okay, so maybe we can get at, constrain, distinguish between these two models. We can't have many high-energy electrons far away from the black hole, or we would see them as this halo. Okay, the other cool thing is that the data, this is synchrotron emission, which should be highly polarized, as of course we've heard, and the spatially resolved VLBI observations can measure full polarization, or at least so far, at least linear polarization, and in the future, probably circular as well. So this is work led by Michael Johnson on the data, one way to view it, and the upshot is basically that we see in Sagittarius A star, there's coherent polarization on scales of these few Schwarzschild radii. And so one way you can look at this is here, is this showing the fractional polarization that's observed as a function of, here it's the visibility amplitude, but you could think of it as the spatial scale, that this is larger scales and this is smaller scales. So what you expect is if the polarization map is completely scrambled, you get something that looks like this. If it's completely uniform, there's no change with spatial scale, then you get something like this. And the real data are somewhere in between. So there's coherent polarization, there's large, the polarization fraction rises to as you go to longer baselines. But it's also not completely uniform or completely scrambled. So I think there's an interesting question that theorists need to ask, which is, you know, what do we actually expect the polarization to look like in these sources? Okay, so again, this goes back to Bromley, Melia, and Liu. This image here shows polarization. So this is vertical polarization here because it's coming from behind the accretion flow. And horizontal here. So this is really just mapping out the toroidal field of the disk. When you look behind the accretion flow, you see a different field geometry than when you look at the stuff that's approaching you. Okay. So we can ask now from simulations with this code that Monica mentioned with full GR radiative transfer, we can just ask, you know, in the simulations, do we get that result? And from the magnetic field geometry, yes, we do. So this is the polarization map similar that was shown before, just showing that, again, we get vertical polarization here and here and horizontal here and here. The MRI does not tangle the polarization. So the shear in the flow, the field is weak, shears it out, and you get a mostly toroidal configuration. And absent plasma effects, you should then expect something that looks like was predicted before. Okay, but as was discussed in the last talk, actually, that's not the limit we're in. We're in this interesting kind of mildly, maybe, in the models, we're certainly in this mildly relativistic electron limit where the plasma effects matter. And so if you include the Faraday rotation and conversion, your nice kind of toroidal field becomes something that looks more like this. So this is not the dramatic limit that Monica just showed, and the models in the galactic center are a little different, but nonetheless, you expect that this should limit how coherent your polarization appears on small scales in the images. And this, as far as I know, was originally pointed out by Roman Shcherbakov that these effects can be quite strong. Okay, just quickly, we understand why that's the case. So analytically, this has been known for a long time, actually, that if you have high frequency limit, so nu over nu c is large in for synchrotron emission, and you have mildly relativistic electrons, so kT over mc squared is, you know, not too large, then this here is the ratio of the Faraday rotation strength to the absorption in the plasma, just showing that it can become quite large. And this is basically the same statement that absorption becomes weak at high frequency. And so the key here is that in the models, again, often the peak of the spectrum that we see is set by self-absorption. So if we actually have tau of 1 in this limit, then we should expect pretty strong Faraday effects. And you can also see here that it's very dependent on the temperature and on this nu over nu c. And so that means that actually putting constraints on how much Faraday rotation can be there in the source itself, how scrambled up this polarized images are, and then immediately places constraints on the plasma parameters. Again, we can see a simple example of that just comparing two images, one where we have a weaker field, so we change basically this nu over nu c, and have a thinner disk. And both of these effects basically make nu over nu c larger, and the Faraday effects are stronger. We're more in this high frequency limit where Faraday rotation wins. And over here we use, this is a MAD model actually, with a stronger field, a thicker accretion flow. Both those effects lead to nu over nu c being smaller, and now the Faraday rotation goes away, and the polarization traces the underlying field geometry again. Okay, and so just as a sample exercise, a preliminary calculation done by this new PhD student, Alejandra, in our group, you can just calculate this, change this ratio by just considering different models, and just calculate basically the correlation length in your polarized image, so as an idea for trying to relate to what can be measured with the data. And so here, when the Faraday effects are weak, the coherence is just limited by the magnetic field direction, by this toroidal winding, and so you get a large correlation length. Here it's completely scrambled, images that are similar to what Monica showed before, and we can put the data point for Sag A star. This is very, you know, heuristic, not a quantitative measurement at this point, but you can try to put this on this plot, basically. And then you would say that this is an upper limit on the rotation optical depth in the fluid itself, and this we understand well in terms of the plasma parameters, and so in this way you can get back to the underlying conditions in the accretion flow from the measured polarization. Okay, so just to summarize, we have this very exciting opportunity now in the next few years to actually spatially resolve scales comparable to the event horizon in at least two sources. It's kind of hard to, you know, you saw from that radius how large of a VLBI array you need. It's going to be harder to go to much smaller scales, right? We need to then leave the Earth, basically, at least in the millimeter. We have this great opportunity in two sources with this EHT experiment in the millimeter and this gravity experiment in the infrared. The first prediction for the Event Horizon Telescope is that the images should be this crescent shape, which is this combination of Doppler beaming from fast orbital motion near the black hole and light bending that lets you see behind the black hole. And I've also discussed a few examples, ongoing work, that really the key challenge is if all the models are going to look like these crescents, it's great for the black hole shadow and bad for testing accretion theory. You think, you know, you get the image right down next to the event horizon, it's perfect, we'll learn everything. And then it's like, well, you'll see a lot of light bending. So we need to think a little harder, but luckily we have a lot more, you know, there's a lot more data. This, you know, calculating the images is really, you know, literally the simplest thing to do. So we need to and have started going beyond this. So I gave a few examples from our group of just showing that the MRI, the MHC turbulence, can explain the properties of the variability. That needs to be made more quantitative. If there are these high energy electrons that extend far away from the black hole, we should see them. So I think we can rule those out, or at least put constraints on those. And again, we can get nice quantitative constraints on, you know, kind of the strength, the relative strength of the magnetic field, the scale height of the accretion flow, or other really key parameters for the models from how coherent the polarization is on small scales from the steroid irritation effect. Okay, thanks very much.
Sorry, maybe this is... Okay, just a naive question. So how will you convince a skeptic that you're not actually just seeing an anisotropic source and really an event horizon?
I think that's a great question. So there's a... I think, yeah, I mean, even in particular, say that you're looking at something, so that, you know, I show that minimum schematically in the visibility profile, you know, anything, a uniform disk has a minimum, right? A lot of things have Bessel functions as their Fourier transforms. So that alone is not good enough, is the point. And so I think, you know, as I said, to me, one of the keys is that we know the spatial scale that should be involved. And I think that helps a lot, that, you know, if there's other features in the image that... The other thing that's important is that it should be static in time, the structure, so the brightness can change. But, you know, in the movie, you see there's all this other stuff going on. So my worry, you know, in part, is that there's other foreground emission or other things that could really fool you and change those visibilities a lot. But the feature we're looking for actually should be stationary. And then there's also properties of the polarization or other things that we can look for. But I actually think that will be a big challenge. There's a fun, at the collaboration meeting, so I should say both these efforts are very large international collaborations. And at the last collaboration meeting for the EHT, they did an exercise where the audience had to vote. So they put up image reconstructions from actual models with actual, you know, algorithms and simulated noise and stuff. And you just had to vote, is that a black hole shadow? Yes or no? And the results were actually quite telling that, you know, I think there's still some, even within the collaboration, still some work to be done on that.
So Monica was showing us a pretty good case for MH7. Obviously, it looks like a jet. If you're doing you're doing the same spin, but you're saying, well, it could be a jet or it could be the flow. If they're the same spin, why would they be different?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think the key difference in the models is what you assume about the electrons. So if you take
why
a model,
the
if you take
electrons, think there was anything different in the flow, or that they're the same. Roughly the same Eddington, or is Sagittarius?
So I think the big difference actually is just that radiative cooling should be important for M87. But I don't think it really changes this issue. So the, you know, if you try to update these models and say, we really know that this new electron temperature prescription is right, that the electrons only get heated in the highly magnetized regions, then you get models similar to what Sasha showed. So the radio emission that, you know, could be non-thermal electrons in the disk or the jet, it really would be the jet then in these models. But as you saw maybe from his images, once you get down to the horizon scales, they look, the images still come out like these crescents. So I think there are ways to tell them apart, because I think these, if it's really this jet wall, it looks to me, at least by eye, that like it has a lot more structural variability to it. So I discussed variability in the unresolved, you know, light curve sense, but we also get this from the data. Once there's high enough signal to noise, you should see structural variability on our timescales, which you can measure in the galactic center, right? Those are good timescales. And so I think you can start to really distinguish models where it looks like in these models it's just more wispy because it's this very thin region of the jet wall where things just vary a lot more. So I think we should be able to tell those apart actually with the variability.
Jake. Good talk. You said that the Faraday measure, Faraday rotation, the weaker the field, the more, the less of the Faraday rotation, right? Or is it the other way around?
The other way around.
Okay. Well, in any case, can you put any quantitative constraints on the actual field strength by the degree of?
Yeah, so that's what we would love to do, right? If you could actually back out plasma beta from that would be great. I think the complications are that so the electron temperature enters, which we can constrain in other ways too. The key confusion to me is really what matters is this ratio of b squared over n. That can change either from the field being more or less dynamically important or from the accretion flow just being thicker and closer to virial or thinner. So that is actually a key parameter that I'm not sure I bring this up all the time, that we should actually be able to calculate this, right? There's no cooling. It's in equilibrium. What is actually the thickness of the disk?
But then it's still the degeneracy between the field strength and the electron number.
I'm more confident in being able to measure the electron temperature. I mean, just as an example, if you know the electrons are thermal and somewhat self-absorbed, you know that the temperature is basically the brightness temperature. So actually the temperature can be constrained in a lot of ways. There's really a strong degeneracy between the scale height of the accretion flow itself, how virial it is, and the plasma beta. So.
Any other questions? Okay, come on, folks. This is ultra exciting. Okay.
Okay, so this will be a variant of the question that I asked to Monica. It seems to me that it's going to be very hard to work on the reconstructed image plane, right? So what you're going to want to do with these models, and I want to know if there's plans within the consortium for that, is to observe them with the EHT, essentially with all the oddities associated with that, and then look at what the models are doing on the visibility plane, both real, you know, where you might get the, and I think imaginary, because these offsetted images where you have things on one side, that'll be portrayed on, you know, in the imaginary part. And so are there plans to try and do that? Because I think that has to be the way to approach this ultimately. It's hard.
Yeah, so in the consortium, there's been a huge effort in image reconstruction for, you know, times where you can't use visibility phases, you only have closure phases, and with heterogeneous array and other issues. So there's a huge effort on that, and a lot of that is guided by taking, you know, models similar to these, or really what they want to do, which is the right thing, is to take the widest range of models. I mean, even forget being these, right? This is a very limited class of models. Take everything you can possibly think of and try to image it and see if it, try out different algorithms, see if, you know, what, specifically for the black hole shadow, see what can fool you, basically. On the modeling part, I think, yeah, I've tended to focus more on the visibility stuff because you can measure it now, and I'm confident this year we'll measure it. Maybe not super confident that there'll be an image of Sagittarius from
you
the campaign in this year.
You heard it here.
Well, it's hard, right? There's a lot going on. There's interstellar scattering. There's time variability that doesn't let you do Earth aperture synthesis. There's all, you know, M87 is much better for making an image. This is what I always tell people. So if you really have a counterjet image, that's perfect. Go make the M87 image first. It's time stationary, right? It doesn't have scattering. Anyways. But there's a huge effort in trying to observe the models and see what you can learn about imaging or other things.
By the way, both sources are being observed this season?
Yeah, that's right. So there's approved ALMA observations for both those sources and then actually a handful of other AGN as well.
Any other questions? You're all exhausted. Well, I need you to up your energy level because now we're going to have a discussion led by Chris Squared. Oh, wait, Sasha.
So what's the next big step on the theory side that will allow us to constrain the physics of accretion?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think there's already from the models that exist or the new models that you guys are working, I mean, there's a lot of things that have not been quantitatively compared to data. And you actually can do that in this case, right? It's in X-ray binaries, people have excuses of, you know, you can't make a truncated disk, you can't do a properly thin disk, you can't do all these things. It's very hard to include the radiation. And here we have a lot of the data in the submillimeter. And it seems like, you know, a lot of the work is saying, well, the size is basically consistent with what's observed. Spectrum doesn't look too bad. It's a good model. I think there's a lot to do with the new models. I'm actually fairly happy with where the models are from the point of view of let's go rule those out and then do something else. On the theory side, I guess you'd have to tell me what's coming, what's the next big. I mean, no, really, the electron physics stuff is a huge advancement. I think the other area in the galactic center where we really don't know is, right, we start with the gas next to the black hole. We assume it's circularized and has a weak magnetic field. What if there's a dynamically important field out at the Bondi radius, right, like this Faraday rotation inference from the magnetar? What if it's all, you know, like these simulations from the Whaley-Penn group where it's just these cold filaments raining down on the center? Does it ever circularize? You know, is this just a crazy initial condition that we should throw out? So doing large-scale stuff is the other big thing.
Okay, let's thank Jason again.